Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. The alleged killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues to receive international headlines. Who was he? What do we know now? What don't we know? In his final column for The Washington Post, which was published on Wednesday, he wrote, quote, "The Arab world needs a modern version of the old transnational media so citizens can be informed about global events. More important, we need to provide a platform for Arab voices. We suffer from poverty, mismanagement, and poor education. Through the creation of an independent international forum, isolated from the influence of nationalist governments spreading hate through propaganda, ordinary people in the Arab world would be able to address the structural problems their societies face." End quote. Well, joining us to talk about coverage of all of this is Borzu Daragahi, is an international correspondent for The Independent, covering the Middle East, Europe, and North Africa, and he has been writing extensively about the alleged killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We're also joined by Lee Fong, an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. Lee is the author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. His recent piece in The Intercept looks at how Saudi Arabian media outlets are covering the alleged murder of Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, Turkey. And hi, Lee. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do, we first start off on a positive note by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Lee, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There's been so much quality coverage of the Khashoggi saga and scandal, but it's hard to highlight one piece. New York Times has done a lot of great stuff, the Middle East. I do want to highlight one particular piece that's on a different topic. The New Yorker had an article about the case against Harvard on affirmative action from Hua Xu. It's just a fascinating piece that peels back the political history that went into this court case, looking at the kind of political mobilization of a very kind of specific set of Chinese Americans, of folks who are very recent immigrants, who were very well-educated, well-trained, came as doctors and engineers in the late 80s and early 90s, who have mobilized around WeChat, the Chinese messaging app, and how through a mixture of actual grievance and victimization, and actually a lot of fake news of complete conspiracy theories, they've mobilized into a very powerful force that could really reshape the entire future of affirmative action in this country. And it's really just a very nuanced look at the entire issue. And the trial started this week, so it's very timely.
Wow, I hadn't heard that angle. We should do a show about this because, where did you see this again?
This was in the New Yorker.
In the New Yorker. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We should do a show about that one because this is a really important case. And we'll put a link to it at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Borzu? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I mean, I've been sort of, neck deep in this Jamal Khashoggi story from here in Istanbul. But I think just for a distraction, I thought it was just really fascinating and compelling. I read the sort of New York Times piece, it was yesterday, that was stories from men talking about their regrets about things they had done to women. And it was sort of this interesting kind of fascinating kind of piece related to the Me Too movement in the U.S. And I think there was a lot of, universal themes that were struck there in that piece, in these stories of these men talking about the things that they had done to women, the sort of overriding shame that came out of it, this sort of things that they had done decades ago, and how much it continued to shape them and haunt them.
Wow.
And I thought that was fascinating, something really interesting to look at.
Wow, that sounds so fascinating. Thank you for that one. We'll also find that and put that on our website, yourcallradio.org. As you said, Borzu, you have been writing extensively about the alleged killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And can you first remind us, who was Jamal Khashoggi? I mean, we keep hearing this word dissident. We keep hearing that he was a journalist, that he was actually closely connected to the Saudi kingdom. Can you tell us, who was he exactly?
I mean, first and foremost, he was a journalist, but he comes from a very powerful and well-known, well-established Saudi family that is non-royal, but had very extensive connections to the royal family. He you know, was a passionate journalist. He was a passionate writer, reporter, foreign correspondent, but an editor of publications. But he also had a role as a sort of consigliere to the Crown Prince Turkey Faisal, who was a former intelligence chief, former ambassador to the U.S. and the U.K. And you know, that gave him a certain level of access that you know, maybe normal journalists wouldn't have. Once he became a dissident last year, when he left Saudi Arabia after being very discontent with the rise of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the new crown prince, he found himself in a very unique position. On the one hand, he was a journalist. On the other hand, he was very well connected in D.C. sort of think tank and commentary circles. He had good ties with the royals, who were also against MBS, and he also had good ties with, you know, liberal, leftist, Islamist activists. All of them knew and to some extent respected him. So he was in a very unique and powerful position, though he was more than anything just a journalist.
Why did he leave Saudi Arabia last year?
Well, I mean, you know, there was a power struggle in Saudi Arabia with the rise of King Salman. The previous crown prince was deposed, and the favored son of King Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, became the crown prince. He started basically being de facto ruler of the kingdom. And, you know, to a large extent, he started really cracking down on any kind of dissent, any kind of critique. And, you know, Jamal Khashoggi found himself on the wrong side of that. And for a while, I know him. I would call him or email him, and he would say, you know, Borzu, I'm sorry, I've been ordered not to talk.
Hmm.
And then suddenly he was out of the country.
Wow. You know, Borzu, you have a recent piece in The Independent. You spoke with a U.S.-based analyst with extensive ties to the kingdom. And talk about what they said to you about Khashoggi's disappearance and why this happened.
Well, I mean, this was one of the things that people were saying to me, was that, you know, it had to do more with, you know, who he was and his position in the kingdom, and in particular, mistrust by Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, toward Jamal Khashoggi and the Khashoggi family over a business deal, the details of which I am, you know, sort of strange, but I've been asked not to disclose for security reasons.
Hmm.
And this business deal that went bad fed mistrust and anger by MBS towards Khashoggi and the rest of the family. And there was a suspicion that Jamal Khashoggi was acting as a sort of rallying point for those who are against MBS abroad. And that might have led to the angry environment that, you know, might have spurred this operation to bring him back to Saudi or possibly kill him.
Because what we're reading in most of the Western media is that it was because of what he wrote about in the Washington Post. But this U.S.-based analyst told you something different.
This story was based on numerous sources. I think his position as a Washington Post columnist was, you know, problematic for MBS. But if you look at, for example, you know, Madawi al-Rashid is a London-based, an amazing scholar who's written very eloquently in multiple languages, much harsher things about MBS and about the Saudi royal family. She was in the New York Times either today or yesterday calling for a constitutional monarchy and basically an abolition of the system of governance right now. So it wasn't the harshness of the criticism. It was this man's unique position as both a critic and a rallying point.
Hmm. Lee, you have been writing about Saudi Arabia for many, many years. What strikes you about how Jamal Khashoggi is being covered here in the West? And then we'll talk about the piece you wrote about how the Saudi media is covering this.
I mean, I think this is just a tipping point. There have been so many scandals that you've seen covered with respect to Saudi Arabia's human rights record, with their foreign policy, what's going on inside the kingdom, where it's kind of cast as an aside that, you know, there's a dominant frame that's been pitched very heavily by Saudi Arabia and their American consultants and PR representatives that, you know, this MBS has to ruffle some feathers. He has to, you know, he might have to throw some elbows, but he's a completely Western-friendly figure who's going to democratize, not democratize, who's going to Westernize the country, to bring, you know, more liberal values to the country, and that anything that happens is kind of collateral damage in this quest to remake the country. And, you know, whether it's this apparent abduction of the prime minister in Lebanon, you know, the war in Yemen that's killed thousands of people, the constant crackdown on dissidents and ethnic and religious minorities in Saudi Arabia, you know, all of these scandals that have happened in the last couple of years have been cast as kind of like, you know, this is a footnote, but the big story is political change under MBS. And now with the apparent murder of Khashoggi, you know, this has taken everything that's happened for the last couple of years and brought it to the surface and completely changed the narrative. And, you know, maybe it's because of the position of Khashoggi that he, you know, within the Venn diagram, he occupied a foot in the Western elite foreign policy and think tank world. He had a foot in the critics of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, you know, by kind of aligning himself with Turkey, and which has aligned itself with Qatar. And, of course, he has a foot within the elite Saudi circles. I mean, this is just a very unique figure that positioned him to be influential across many different power circles. Mm. So, you know, apparently that's what it took, but this has completely remade the narrative in the media.
And to add to your list, the beheadings in April, there were stories in The Guardian about Saudi Arabia being criticized for 48 beheadings in 4 months of 2018. Borzu, what are your thoughts about MBS and his brand? I mean, we did a show when he had this PR tour in the U.S. and met with everyone from Oprah to Silicon Valley execs. We did a show about how the media were being mostly uncritical, basically calling this guy a reformer. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that may be changing?
Well, I think that, you know, he is, you know, to a certain extent a reformer. There have been reformers throughout, you know, history in the past few centuries who were, you know, not liberals. Yes, he wanted to reform certain aspects of the Saudi economy, religious institutions, and maybe even social relations a little bit, you know, to sort of modernize the country and so on. But, you know, it wouldn't be anything we would call, you know, Western or liberal or anything like that. Like, decidedly, he didn't want that. So I think it's not inaccurate to call him a reformer. But, you know, he's also, I think the big problem with him isn't necessarily his, you know, reform vision, you know, as encapsulated by his sort of Vision 2030, the plan to bring Saudi Arabia into a post-oil era. I think the big problem with him is his, like, obvious recklessness and just, you know, how unpredictable and unstable the Middle East already is. And then this guy, and I'm sorry, I'm, like, you know, pushing near 50, so I'm going to call him, like, a kid. He comes in, like, sort of charging in, and it's just another really dangerous, unstable factor in this region, you know. And I think that no one really took that into account. I mean, I tried to in the stories that I did last year about the moves he made with regard to, you know, rounding up 500 royal family members, escalating the war in Yemen, you know, kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon. It's just this sort of unpredictability, this loose cannon attitude that he had, which is just really dangerous in a region where there's already, you know, half a dozen countries launching airstrikes on half a dozen other countries, and, you know, armed men being deployed by, you know, shadowy people all over the region. What the last thing you needed was this sort of, young, you know, reckless prince coming in and stirring stuff up.
Lee?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. It's just that, you know, it's incredible that, you know, none of these kind of unpredictable reflexes or instincts from MBS, you know, they're not hidden. We've seen them reported, but it's hard to find mainstream outlets covering them in a critical way. I mean, this is to see that the change in tenor, the tone of mainstream coverage now is incredible. Although, I mean, there's been evidence of this, as Borzu just mentioned, literally throughout just the last year.
What about the piece you wrote, Lee? Saudi media casts Khashoggi's disappearance as a conspiracy and claims Qatar owns the Washington Post. What did you find when you looked at media outlets in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'm just fascinated at the rise of misinformation through social media and news. You know, for authoritarian politicians and political figures all across the globe, you see this dynamic. You know, whether you're in Myanmar and the spread of fake news through Facebook, in Brazil, we're seeing the rise of the PSL, you know, the Jair Bolsonaro's party, using WhatsApp to spread conspiracy theories and really dominate the election there, and it looks like he's going to win. Just using WhatsApp and spreading absolutely false information, claiming that you know, leftists want to give prisoners, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 stipends when they're in prison, that, you know, the leftist parties want to force children into, you know, homosexual relationships. I mean, it's really ludicrous stuff, but it's believed by a significant part of the population because there's this absolute spread of misinformation. And in the Saudi government, you see, I think, a very similar dynamic with them reflexively after the murder of Khashoggi, using these outlets that are controlled by royal family members or have connections to the government to spread falsehoods or exaggerations. You know, Khashoggi did have some relationships with Muslim Brotherhood outlets. He did attend some forums hosted by Qatar. But, you know, he's much more complicated than that. You know, he's relationships with lots of political figures, and their reflexive instinct is to spread this conspiracy that he was simply, you know, an intelligence agent for Qatar, that Qatar literally owns the Washington Post, and that's why Khashoggi wrote for them. I mean, they also claim that through the Saudi newspapers and online sources that the 15 supposed hitmen that were sent to Istanbul to murder him, that these were simply Saudi tourists, and to criticize this incident, it's, you know, a Turkish media or Western media effort to demonize Saudi tourists. I mean, it's really ludicrous stuff, but it's posted everywhere. It's part of the kind of mainstream government discourse, and unfortunately, that's the world we live in. It's hard to kind of correct this misinformation. Mm-hmm.
Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. His recent piece in The Intercept looks at the Saudi Arabia media outlet's propaganda war against the disappearance and alleged murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. We're also joined by Borzu Dargahi, an international correspondent for The Independent, covering the Middle East, Europe, and North Africa. And it's Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are talking about media coverage of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Borzu, let's talk about, you know, it's so interesting to see how the Saudis have not been able to change the narrative. And at least when it comes to, you know, outside of Saudi Arabia, you have written extensively about the Turkish government and the leaks, the daily leaks to pro-government newspapers. Before we get into the details, why do you think Turkey is doing this? Can you explain their role in all of this?
Well, I think that, you know, Turkey is facing multiple pressures. You know, on the one hand, this apparent killing, it is really outrageous. In Turkey, you know, in Istanbul, this kind of thing is not something that they would accept a foreign government doing. You know, just like the killing of the Russian double agents in London last year, the Skirpal father and daughter was outrageous in the UK and created an uproar. So it's under tremendous domestic pressure to get to the bottom of this. On the other hand, you know, its economy is in a tough situation, and one of the things that has kept the economy stable and not, you know, collapsing is Gulf money. Real estate sales, for example, have remained flat, despite the fact that the economy has had this, listeners may recall, the economy has had this dramatic a downturn over the last few months, with the lira down 40% this year, the Turkish currency. And so it needs, it doesn't want to, you know, has no interest whatsoever in blowing up relations with Saudi Arabia. And yet, you know, it has this tremendous rivalry with Saudi Arabia right now. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan does not like MBS, views him as a reckless X factor that he doesn't want to deal with at this time. And he doesn't like the direction of U.S. Foreign policy. Turkey is an ally, staunch ally of Qatar, which Saudi Arabia is trying to isolate and crush, really, this tiny country in the Persian Gulf. Saudi Arabia is opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood, and Turkey hosts the Muslim Brotherhood, and so on. So, you know, you've got the situation where Turkey and Saudi Arabia find themselves on opposite sides of a few issues. Turkey would like Saudi Arabia and the Trump administration not to be so close together, and it sees an opportunity in doing that. So by having Erdogan talk nicely and politely and, you know, meet with Saudi officials and so on and make very diplomatic comments while at the same time aggressively leaking all this dirt about the investigation and all the things that they know, they can play this sort of dual strategy of pressuring the Saudis without rupturing the relationship.
And from the very beginning, Turkish officials have leaked information about how Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the consulate. They gave passport photos to news organizations. You know, as a longtime journalist in the region, Borzu, how credible is this information?
I think that much of it is very credible, and I know this just because, you know, having lived in Turkey here for 3 years and having covered it for more than 10 years, you know, there is this sort of symbiotic relationship between the security forces here and some members of the press, and it's not as sinister as it sounds. You know, in a lot of cases, these guys grew up together, so you have the local Turkish journalist saying, hey, you know, Mehmet, give me a scoop, let me look at that security camera footage, let me take those pictures. And with the proliferation of, you know, WhatsApp and Signal and so on, everyone knows about this stuff, so they can securely send it back and forth, and, you know, it's very hard to figure out who leaked this information. But I think in this particular case, it's the, you know, I have a suspicion that it's the president's office directly kind of guiding these leaks, because they seem to show up, you know, very frequently in certain key U.S. publications, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, and, you know, these are why those publications? Because that's who they're trying to influence. They're trying to influence Washington to influence Saudi.
Let's take a call. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program. I have two quick comments, very disturbing. One of them has to do with the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And the Saudis, and that appeared in the French newspaper, L'Express, which I read occasionally. It had to do with the fact that the Saudis, over the years, financed the R&D program of the Pakistanis to develop nuclear weapons and missiles, and that the Saudis have acquired the rights to import that stuff and use it, presumably, against Iran. I would like to hear your comments about that, if you've heard anything about that. The other thing has to do quickly with the fact that
Max, reserves have been discovered. Max, first off, just on your first question, let's see if Borzu or Lee have heard about that. No, Lee?
I've read that too, but I can't comment. I know there's been stories just over the years that if Iran does develop a nuclear weapon, that Saudi Arabia would quickly acquire one from Pakistan, and, you know, this, we'll have a lot of proliferation in the region.
Borzu?
Well, I mean, I don't know if Pakistan has an interest in doing that. I don't think Pakistan has been very, very reluctant to take part in the Saudi confrontation against Iran. Pakistan needs Iran for natural gas. They're building the so-called peace pipeline that links Iran to Pakistan, to India. And, you know, and Pakistan has systematically refused to do that. So I don't know if they would. I don't know. Iran is not near having a nuclear weapon at this point. And B, I don't think that Pakistan would necessarily give its nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia in that case.
All right, thank you. Max, you had another question?
A quick comment. Apparently some huge gas or oil reserves have been discovered in by the United Arab Republic or whatever, enormous reserves, apparently bigger than the Saudi reserves. I don't know if I buy that, but that appeared, that was, I think, it was exposed also in L'Express, the French newspaper. And I wonder if you've heard anything about that. And they were talking about using fracking. Perhaps it's a very disturbing thought, which start exploiting these reserves.
Borzu, have you heard anything about that?
UAE is a rather small country. There's seven emirates. One of them has all the oil, the Abu Dhabi emirate, and all the rest are sort of, they don't have a lot of energy reserves. Maybe there's reserves underneath. I don't think our planet is going to last if they keep sucking this stuff out of the earth.
Mm. Well, thank you, Max. Borzu, what are you working on right now before we let you go?
Just sort of following the news on this stuff and a couple other stories that I'm not allowed to talk about.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing them. Borzu, thanks for your work and thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi is an international correspondent for The Independent, covering the Middle East, Europe, and North Africa. And we have to do an entire show about Saudi Arabia because there was so much that we did not get to, including all of the corporations that are fine doing business with Saudi Arabia as it bombs Yemen. And now they say that they are pulling out, including Uber, a number of investment firms, a very long list of U.S. corporations. So we'll definitely do a show about that soon. And joining us for the rest of the hour, Lee Fong, investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. After the break, we'll also be joined by Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica, who's out with a huge investigation called Trump's Patron-in-Chief. Casino magnate Sheldon Adelson has never been more powerful. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. More on the Khashoggi tragedy, as well as more stories from the week on 1A coming your way at 11 here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Lee Fong, investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. He is the author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. And now I would like to welcome Justin Elliott to the show. Justin is a reporter with ProPublica covering money and politics and the NSA. His recent investigation details the deep connections between Donald Trump and mega donor Sheldon Adelson, who says that Israeli policies are at the very top of his list. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
It's great to have you. So the story you wrote was co-published with WNYC. This is a really great story that really proves that Donald Trump is using the White House as a business platform. You reveal that Sheldon Adelson and his wife, Miriam, were among Trump's biggest benefactors. They doled out $20 million for his campaign, another $5 million for the inaugural festivities. They're spending $55 million to make sure that Republicans control the House. Sheldon Adelson said he's a one-issue guy, and that issue is Israel. First off, talk about what we need to know about Sheldon Adelson and how he ended up being such a big and influential player in Republican Party politics.
Sure. So, Adelson, and I think it's actually pronounced Adelson,
okay.
although many people say Adelson, including some people that know him. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's one of the richest people in the world. His money is from his casino company, Las Vegas Sands. He's purported to be worth around $35 billion. And, you know, he's actually been giving money to Republican politicians going back to the 80s, but it's really accelerated in recent years to the point where he seems to be probably the biggest donor, the biggest single donor. Right now in the midterms, I think some new filings came out showing that his giving in the midterms is up to something like $90 million.
Wow.
And as you say, he identifies himself as a one-issue guy, and the issue is Israel. He's aligned with the sort of the right wing in Israel. But I was also trying to look at how his financial interests have fared under President Trump, and it turns out, the Trump administration has been good for his bottom line.
Lee, you have been writing about Sheldon Adelson for many, many years. We just found a piece from 2012 that you wrote in the Republic Report called AIPAC Used Casino Magnate Sheldon Adelson's Private Jet Company to Ferry Members of Congress to Israel.
Yeah, that's right. You know, he's a major donor like the Koch brothers. You know, he's been a feature of Republican politics for a very long time. I mean, I remember really interesting reporting around him a decade ago, covering how he had funded key congressional Republicans to influence China policy as he attempted to open casinos in Macau. So, you know, he's been a longtime fixture, but, you know, as an individual, he's someone that has fairly extreme views, particularly on Middle East policy. You know, he's kind of semi-joked, semi-kind of spoken in earnest about bombing Iran. He's kind of been open about an interest in removing Palestinians from the West Bank. You know, these are not views that are mainstream in America. These aren't views that I think most Americans have, but because of his incredible financial resources, plowing money into super PACs, potentially into dark money groups as well, but we're not quite clear, given that they don't disclose their donors. Mm. He's able to mainstream these views, to force them upon our elected officials, and to remake American policy. Even though, again, a lot of these views are very unusual. Like these aren't, you know, normal people don't say, you know, wake up thinking, hey, we'd like war in the Middle East, but. Adelson, because of his influence, he's able to shape the entire administration.
And so if you wrote this 6 years ago and you've been covering him for a long time, Lee, what are your thoughts about other media outlets covering someone as powerful as Adelson? He's never had as much influence on a politician before Trump, but he has had influence. Why haven't we heard more about him just in mainstream conversations about the influence of money in politics?
Well, look, I mean, there's been an effort to aggressively bully media outlets that do cover him. There was the scandal from quite a few years ago where a number of documentary makers went to Macau and kind of covered this growing corruption scandal where it looked like Adelson's company had potentially bullied whistleblowers. They might have violated Foreign Corrupt Practices Acts in bribing, potentially bribing Chinese officials to open up casinos. And there's been a lot of litigation around that, a lot of legal threats. And I know that documentary was eventually killed. And the folks that were producing it were facing a lot of pressure. And at the same time, it's hard to kind of describe these politics when you're just covering the kind of daily beat. It's not outrageous anymore for a billionaire to drop $20 million. We've had the last four election cycles, three or four election cycles, where super PACs are just every day generating these huge seven-figure and eight-figure numbers. And I think for a lot of reporters and even a lot of viewers at home, they kind of tune out. They go, okay, well, here's another billionaire dropping money in. This isn't a scandal. This is now normal. So it's hard to kind of get eyeballs or clicks when something has become so normalized, even though it is a very extreme feature of American politics.
Well, and the other thing is, in the case of your piece, Justin, that is really incredible. I mean, I have it printed out, and I think it's about 20 or so pages. When did Sheldon Adelson enter your radar, and why did you decide to write this investigation?
Yeah, well, he actually entered my radar on this particular piece because I had written a previous piece about some casino issues in Asia and the Trump administration, and as part of that reporting, I'd heard, I'd essentially got a tip that that we should be looking at what was happening in Japan with Adelson. So just to briefly give you some background, you know, as Lee was saying, Adelson's company actually gets most of its money now from its casinos in Macau, which is the southern territory in China. But they're looking, they also have a big casino in Singapore, and they're looking to expand to Japan. Japan actually just legalized casinos. They don't exist there right now. And they're only going to be issuing a limited, number of licenses. So there's a big competition right now among all these big casino companies to get one of these, to essentially convince the Japanese government to get one of these licenses. So one of the things I looked at was it turns out that Trump actually raised Adelson's company in a meeting with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, which, you know, is again not something that's normal for a president to do with a foreign head of state. And this has actually become an issue in Japanese politics. You know, the legalizing casinos is very controversial there. Most people are opposed to it, and some opposition politicians are now saying, accusing Abe of sort of tailoring the legalization bill and the regulations to Trump and his donors. And, you know, we definitely don't have a clear picture. You know, I can't say for sure that that's happening, but this is clearly sort of in the mix.
This is really an incredible story, Justin. You write that late on a Thursday evening in February 2017, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's plane landed at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. It was his first visit with Trump. I remember the constant media coverage of this. You report a few hours earlier, Sheldon Adelson's Boeing 737, which is so large it can seat 149 people, touched down at Reagan National Airport after a flight from Vegas. They all had a business breakfast. And following that, Abe, Japanese Prime Minister Abe, had a meeting with Trump before boarding Air Force One for a weekend at Mar-a-Lago. The two heads of state dined with Patriots owner Bob Kraft and golfed at Trump's Jupiter Golf Club. During the meeting at Mar-a-Lago that weekend, Trump raised Adelson's casino bid to Abe, according to two people briefed on the meeting, and the Japanese side was surprised. According to one of the people briefed on the exchange, they said, quote, "It was totally brought up out of the blue. They were a little incredulous that he would be so brazen," end quote. After Trump told Abe he should strongly consider Las Vegas Sands for a license, that's Adelson's casino, Abe didn't really respond and said, "Thank you for the information." How unusual is this?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be very unusual. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not unheard of for presidents of both parties to, like, bring up, you know, for example, like, some kind of major aircraft sale of Boeing or something, like a sort of quasi-national company like that. But to bring up, you know, the business interests of your major donor's casino company is not normal. And, you know, the other thing about that meeting was, like, the night before, or a couple nights before, Adelson, you know, had a private dinner with President Trump at the White House, I mean, which is part of an amazing amount of access that he's getting. I mean, again, to sort of echo what Lee was saying, I think this is a sort of extreme aspect of American politics that's become, you know, even more normalized under Trump than it was before, which is you have somebody like Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam, who are private citizens. You know, they haven't been elected to anything, but they've given, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. And, you know, he's dining at the White House more than once. He is talking to Trump on the phone regularly. New York Times said it was once a month. You know, it's difficult to report on this stuff because when it's Sheldon Adelson and Trump on the phone, you know, there's very small group of people that know what was said. So a lot, it might just be the two of them in some cases. So we don't really have a very clear picture of what Adelson is asking for, other than, you know, it seems clear that he has been a major force on some of these Israel-Palestine policy questions, like the moving of the embassy.
Right, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Lee, what would you say about reporting on someone like Adelson when they have phone calls with Donald Trump? I mean, how are you able to get information about what's actually happening behind the scenes?
I mean, it's very difficult, and, you know, this story from Justin is incredible because it really shows, maybe not a quid pro quo, but the kind of normalization of incredible exchange of financial benefits and political power. You have to kind of go through all kinds of sources. And you know, just looking through Justin's piece, you know, he's covering from the Japanese perspective, which has been reported in their media outlets, looking at documents, looking at emails, and looking at kind of anecdotal things in terms of when people meet and when things happen. And Trump has been, you know, a lot of politicians do this, but he's been so brazen in that, you know, in the last couple months of the 2016 campaign, most big billionaires and corporations cast their lot with Hillary Clinton, but a select few private prison companies, mining companies, people like Sheldon Adelson spent big to elect Trump, and that money really helped put him over the top, especially in the Midwestern states where they focused on some of the ad campaign. And he's gone back and said, okay, I'm going to basically, what it appears like, he's going back and rewarding all of those late campaign donors. The private prison companies are benefiting under Trump. He's asking for more appropriations for them. The mining companies are getting big bailouts and regulatory decisions that benefit them. And here, with whether it's the tax bill or moving of the embassy, another Israeli policy, or this Japanese casino, he's really rewarding Adelson, who spent a lot to support Trump.
He spent a lot to support Trump, but he sure got it back from the Trump tax break.
That's right.
And Justin, as you report, the Adelson lobbied the Republicans to change the tax law so it would further benefit him. He got $1.2 billion this year. What did he do exactly, and what did he get?
Yeah, I mean, the tax law, I think that the tax bill really hasn't gotten enough attention. I think besides the sort of judiciary, you know, Trump's judicial appointments, I think this is the biggest thing that he's done. And part of the reason it hasn't gotten enough attention is that it's very complicated and gets boring very quickly. But the brief version is that, Las Vegas Sands, Adelson's company, hired lobbyists that lobbied both Congress and the Treasury Department on some issues related to foreign tax credits that, again, get quite complicated but are very important for Sands in particular because it operates in Macau, which has very high taxes. But long story short, you know, they've reported on their in their public investor filings that the tax bill was worth $1.2 billion to the company related to the same foreign tax credit issue that they lobbied on. So the Adelson family controls, I think, something like 55% of the company. So yeah, that's something that we do know through public documents. It, you know, is a absolutely massive benefit that the Adelson family has gotten. Now, obviously, basically all corporations benefited from the tax bill, but this seems to be a particularly big number for Sands.
Today we're speaking with Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica covering money and politics. I hope you can check out his latest investigation. It's a lengthy investigation, about 30 pages, really worth your time. Trump's patron-in-chief, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, has never been more powerful. The Trump administration has advanced his ideological and finance interests, including an assist in his quest to build a casino in Japan. We're also joined by Lee Fong, an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. Lee's author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. Lee, in Justin's piece, Craig Holman with Public Citizen said, quote, "I would put Adelson at the very top of the list of both access and influence in the Trump administration. I've never seen anything like it before, and I've been studying money and politics for 40 years.
I think that's fair. That's a fair quote. I mean, you see these stories where not only is Trump regularly calling Adelson for advice, but the kind of movers and shakers in the Republican Party are constantly flying to Las Vegas to solicit ideas and then ask for money. Corey Bliss, the executive director of the largest Republican super PAC, working on the House side to elect Republicans to Congress, supposedly he just goes regularly to Las Vegas and says, you know, we need more money, and what do you need? And Paul Ryan often goes on those trips. I mean, this is someone who has a foothold in Washington in the Republican establishment, but also the foreign policy establishment. Lots of think tanks go to him for money. The Republican Jewish Coalition is a very powerful political group. One of their top figures is former Senator Norm Coleman, who's also a lobbyist for Saudi Arabia. He's very close to Adelson. I mean, the kind of concentric ties bring together the power elite that really controls the the levers of government right now, they're all connected to Adelson.
So let's talk more about his Israel policy, Trump and Adelson's Israel policy. In your piece, Justin, last year Adelson said, quote, "I'm a one-issue person. That issue is Israel," end quote. On that issue, you report, Trump has delivered. The administration has slashed funding for aid to Palestinian refugees and scrapped the Iran nuclear deal. Attending the recent opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, Adelson seemed to almost weep with joy, according to an attendee. But as you report, at first Adelson wasn't sure about Trump. And then New York investor Michael Steinhardt called Jared Kushner and said that Sheldon would like to meet your father-in-law. Trump got on a plane to Las Vegas. Tell us what else you found.
Yeah, I mean, the history is actually kind of interesting. You know, back in the early stages of the Republican primary, when there were still so many candidates, Trump actually a few times attacked Adelson. There's like a tweet where he says something along the lines of Adelson's giving money to Marco Rubio because Adelson wants to turn him into his perfect little puppet or something like that. But, you know, after Trump locked up the nomination, Adelson got behind him and, you know, became one of, if not the biggest donor to the sort of pro-Trump side in the back in the 2016 campaign, yeah, I mean, as you noted, he's been transparent about the fact that he's sort of primarily motivated, or he says he's primarily motivated by the Israel issue, and you know, in particular, there was this controversial question of the location of the U.S. Embassy for, you know, I found a story going back into the mid-90s where Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam, who's actually Israeli-American, were lobbying on the Hill to try to get Congress to pass legislation to move the embassy to Jerusalem. This is significant because Palestinians claim East Jerusalem as their capital, and you know, and basically the entire world, except for the U.S. now, and I think Guatemala, recognize the Palestinian claim to Jerusalem. So, you know, even, you know, presidents of both parties, Obama, George Bush, Clinton, had declined to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So Trump broke with, you know, two decades, I guess, of bipartisan precedent on that. And earlier this year, they did move the embassy to Jerusalem. You know, Adelson, you can watch a video of it online. If you look at the front row of this opening ceremony, you know, had Jared Kushner and Ivanka were there and spoke. You had cabinet secretaries like Steve Mnuchin, you had Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, and then you had Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. Again, these are private citizens. It's become normal to see them like in the front row of major events like this, where everyone else is like a head of state or cabinet secretary.
And you also have interesting information here about Donald Trump's decision to fire National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and replace him with John Bolton. Can you, very hawkish John Bolton, can you quickly give us the backstory there, what you found?
Sure. So it's a little bit murky, but what we know is there's a pro-Israel group called the Zionist Organization of America that's sort of on the right wing of the pro-Israel community here in the U.S. And Adelson, the Adelson family are the single biggest funders to the ZOA, as it's called. And last year, this group, ZOA, started a big public campaign attacking H.R. McMaster, who at the time was the Trump national security advisor. They were accusing him of being too friendly to Iran, of supposedly having animus towards Israel. You know, soon after that, a few months later, Trump fired McMaster and replaced him with Bolton. Other people reported that, I think the New York Times reported that Adelson had been advising Trump to give John Bolton, you know, who's this sort of famously hawkish figure from the Bush administration, Adelson had wanted Trump to give him a job, according to the New York Times. So, you know, this group that Adelson funds attacked McMaster, and then McMaster was fired and Bolton was put in. Now, it seems like there probably were some other issues going on there. I'm not claiming that this is sort of solely Sheldon Adelson, you know, puppeteering all this, but you know, when you have a major, if not the biggest, donor to to your party, sort of publicly criticizing a cabinet member, I mean, I think that's like a very significant thing.
Lee, final thoughts on anything else we need to know about Adelson and where he spends his money? Any other organizations that stand out for you?
Look, if you live in any congressional competitive House seat in the country right now, you're seeing TV ads, ads on your Instagram, ads on your Facebook from the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is funded by Adelson, smearing the Democratic candidate. A lot of these ads have a racial tinge. PolitiFact and other fact checkers have noted that it's really to an extreme degree that they use misinformation to attack Democratic candidates. I mean, it's an election season. You see a lot of false claims, but these are particularly bad. But I don't think many Americans know where the money's coming from. I mean, California as a state has truth in advertising laws where the campaigns have to show in small type at the bottom the major funders, but federal elections don't. They just see the ad funded by a Congressional Leadership Fund, which is very vague. They don't know it's Adelson funded.
Hmm. And it seems like Dems and Democrats in many cases are raising more money than Republicans.
They're raising more money for their individual campaigns, but then Republicans have more money on a net basis because of these super PACs funded by Adelson.
Okay.
So, you know, they're raising, you know, record numbers of small donors, individual donors, but then someone just like Adelson and a few others cuts a check for $20 million to kind of evens the playing field.
Because Public Citizen just came out the last few days and said, for the midterms, we've already passed the $5 billion mark, another record.
Incredible.
Lee, what are you working on right now?
Mostly midterm coverage through the election. Lots of races to cover.
Is there anything that's not getting attention that we should know about?
There are a lot of exciting races with really interesting candidates, mostly first-time candidates, folks who were not particularly political before, but now have, you know, won their primaries, are challenging the establishment. You know, they're not getting much attention because they're scattered across the country. You know, folks like Kara Eastman in Omaha, Katie Porter in Orange County. I mean, these are really interesting individuals, but, you know, there's a lot else in the news, so it's kind of hard to track all these races.
What about you, Justin? What are you working on?
Yeah, so I'm working as part of this team. This Adelson story is actually part of a podcast series we're doing with WNYC called Trump Inc. So we're right now we're doing a series of print stories and also with accompanying podcast episodes about both Trump family business issues, but also looking at people sort of in Trump's orbit, like Adelson, and my colleague just did a big story about the Trump family's businesses in Panama. So check out the podcast if you're interested.
Well, great reporting. Thank you so much for your pieces. Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica. Check out his piece, Trump's Patron in Chief. Thank you, Justin, for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Lee Fong is an investigative journalist covering money and politics for The Intercept. He's author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. And Lee's got great stories up at The Intercept. One of his latest is about Saudi media and how it's casting Khashoggi's disappearance as a conspiracy. Lee, as always, thank you for your great work. Thanks for having me. Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Check out our website to listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast, yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and David Latulipe, who is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.